Welcome to Let's Talk. I'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners across the country where the program's broadcast, particularly the local traditional owners, the Jagera, Yuggera, Turrbal and Yugapul peoples, the Yugambeh, Mananjali, Kombamiri, Noonuckle, Quandamooka peoples. I'd also like to acknowledge elders, elders of the First Peoples of the land, and elders of more recent arrivals. Welcome to each and every one of you, and welcome to all our listeners tuned in across the country by the National Indigenous Radio Service and across the world by the World Wide Web. Welcome to you. It's great to have your company. Well, another great weekend. Thanks to Karen Durante for holding the fort on Thursday, Friday, while I attended a funeral down in Dubbo. It was a nice drive. And an 87-year-old local Koori man was laid to rest. And a nice drive home, just over 800k, 850k, I think, one-way trip. Good driving down through Moree and places. Now, what a tragic story over there in the States with all those young kids being shot. By gee, what's going on in some people's minds? It's just unbelievable. Unbelievable. I've got Chris Graham joining me for the first part of the program today, and Jeff Scott, the CEO for the New South Wales Aboriginal Land Council, will come on a little later. And we'll talk to Jeff Scott about a range of things happening with the Land Council. First up, Chris Graham, we might just talk about the gun business over there in the States. How strong is that gun lobby and stuff? Chris, welcome to the program. How are you?
Good, Tugabas. Very good.
How's Sydney this morning?
Well, it's overcast and a bit all over the shop.
All right.
It's kind of was lovely, and it was sort of a nice-ish weekend, but it went a bit crazy by Sunday.
Word about the Christmas and stuff. Is traffic and is business sort of winding down and the crazies? There's more people spilling out of pubs and bars and nightclubs and on the street. They seem to go troppo up here.
Yeah, I've been guilty of that myself,
Tiger. Oh, you do a bit of that too, mate. Right, yeah. Okay, fair enough.
We had our Christmas party last week, and it's fair to say I didn't distinguish myself.
No, it's not Christmas parties. I'm just talking about the general nightlife.
Generally?
I mean, as soon as that first week of December hits, the bars and pubs and that, because I wander around and keep my eyes on the streets and what's going on sometimes, you know, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday nights. And, I see the people just, it's that Christmas thing, Christmas spirit, they're going troppo. There's a lot more people out on the streets.
Yeah,
Does that happen in Sydney?
It does, yeah. Sydney goes crazy. It's sort of, but for us, it starts in October.
Alrighty, Oktoberfest.
Yeah, as soon as it starts to heat up, Sydney people go a bit silly. So our silly season officially starts in October.
Oh, I see.
And it lasts till about February, March. And then it starts to come down. But
from my 15 years down, 16 years or so in Sydney, I thought it was all year round, but it's changed a bit, has it?
It has. It's gotten busy. It has. I went for a drive yesterday with Ange to, I'm not into free plugs, but Costco. I don't know if you've got it up there. It's like a massive, it's like a massive Coles/Kmart all packed into a massive warehouse.
Is it? Never heard of it.
Oh, look, it's an American thing.
You heard of Crisco, that Christmas autumn mob.
Hampers, yeah. Costco is like, you can get anything, but you've got to buy it in bulk.
Oh, right.
In massive, massive tubs. They've got massive shopping trolleys that you walk around with.
So we went in there to have it. Were you?
Yeah, we were looking at it, and you got to join up, and we just went in for a look, and we got out as soon as we possibly could. There were hundreds of people. It was just insane. Mm. The traffic was a nightmare. It was just, it's that time of year.
It is, mate, it is.
You're better off heading bush, I think.
Now, talking about that time of the year and going troppo, I mean, it was a tragic incident over there in the States where someone's gone troppo and shot his dad and gone into a school looking for his mum, and I think he shot her, and then
the media coverage of this was very confused, but they've reported all sorts of things, including blaming the wrong guy for the killing. The guy who's police say has done it is a guy called Adam Lanza. But media initially reported it was a guy called Ryan Lanza. And they posted his image and his Facebook profile all over the world's media. He started tweeting that it wasn't him. He was on a bus on his way home. He was, in fact, the brother of the guy.
Oh, right.
The guy shot his mum first at his home, and apparently there'd been a dispute with his mum the day before at the school that she works at, which is where he did the massacre. But he's then gone to the school and killed another, I think, well, there was 26 in total. So he killed 20 children and another 6 adults, and then himself.
So the media got it terribly wrong then, because they reported that he shot his dad and went looking for his mum who worked at the school.
Yeah, she was in fact killed at her home, and then he went to the school.
Did he get dad at all? So his dad's still alive?
No, his father's still very much alive, and in fact issued a statement yesterday saying, you know, how appalling it was. But, the shooting itself is horrendous. The media coverage, it's just a scramble for people to get news out first, and it doesn't matter that they've A, named the wrong guy as the killer, and B,
got their facts
large
wrong.
Parts of their facts wrong.
Mm.
But I mean, really, in the grand scheme of things, it doesn't matter that much, I suppose. The scale of the tragedy is
for sure. What does this mean in regards to the gun lobby? I mean, is there any real? Well, what are the noises coming out of the White House?
Well, this was really quite interesting because the Obama's press aide came out immediately afterwards and said, "Today is not the day for discussing gun laws." And the response around the world was, well, today is in fact the day you should be discussing gun laws because they're a significant part of why this occurs. And Obama, a few hours later, gave a press conference where he didn't say he was going to tighten up on gun laws, but he did say that there needed to be action, meaningful action, to start tackling the problem, which is as far as I've seen an American president go when something like this happens. Most just, no pun intended, run for cover on this sort of stuff. They don't want to go anywhere near it because of the power of the gun lobbies, the National Rifle Association in particular in the US. So Obama's since been a bit more oblique about what he wants to do. He hasn't come out with any plans yet, and the gun lobby is already out saying, guns don't kill people, people kill people, all the usual stuff. But there was a really good posting from Michael Moore, who's the filmmaker who did Bowling for Columbine. Now, that's the film about the school massacre in Columbine in the 90s by Dylan Klebold and Eric Smith. The same day that this kid shot and killed 20 children in a primary school, a man in China went off next door, began a dispute next door to a school and spilled into the school. The guy stabbed 20 kids. The death toll is zero. But at the same time, a young kid, by all accounts, a very small, he's been described as weak kid, walks into a school and kills 20 with a gun. So, or kills 26, in fact, with a gun, including 20 kids. So, you know, the difference, it couldn't be more stark, the contrast. And gun laws have got to be part of the discussion for how they resolve this. But I don't think we'll see much change, to be honest, Tiger. It's a country with a gun culture. And
it's there to stay.
I think it is. They're just going to have to live with this. They have armed themselves to the teeth. And interestingly, the guns he used were his mother's guns. He used a AR-15, which is a sort of semi-assault rifle. It's kind of the civilian version of the M4 and the M16, which is what the American military use. But it's semi-automatic. It's not automatic, but it's still designed to kill people. It's not designed for hunting. It's designed to get lots of high-velocity bullets away very quickly. That was his mother's weapon. Now, what is a woman who works as a primary school teacher need an assault weapon for? And he also took two pistols from her house, and one was a Glock, which is what Australian police
use. The coppers are using, the Glocks.
I mean, you know, and look, his mum is dead, obviously, but you've got to wonder if she was alive what she would think if it transpired that he's been reported as high-functioning autistic, what would she think now? Would she think it was worth having weapons in her house if she knew what the outcome of that would be? I think the answer is she probably wouldn't think it was worth it. But I just don't understand why an average citizen in the US needs an arsenal of weapons in her house.
Yes, it's weird, isn't it? And look, if there are weapons to be put to be in households, why do they need to be guns that are designed to kill people? I mean, hunting rifles or hunting guns may be a different story.
The AR-15s are, you know, if you want to go hunting, and look, I don't like hunting, but I don't oppose it. I just don't do it. You don't need an assault rifle. What, you're going to fill a deer with 20 bullets? I mean, exactly. If you need to do that, you probably shouldn't be hunting. But I don't understand what the point of these weapons is in a domestic situation. I mean, I'm not against guns at all. I started pistol shooting last year. I haven't kept with it, but I went pistol shooting for a few sessions to see what it was like, and primarily because I'm looking at doing foreign correspondence, so, you know, and I kind of need to know how to use a gun, but I don't own a gun. I don't have problems with people owning guns, but I just don't get why you need this sort of weaponry in your house.
And especially if you've got a child that's he's been diagnosed was.
Look, and again, we're relying on media that have got a lot of stuff wrong.
Yeah, which
but
is
he's
dangerous.
Been reported as being Asperger's, high functioning, which is a form of high functioning autism. Now, I mean, if it's accurate, the big question is, so what? I know a lot of kids with Asperger's, and, you know, they're the gentlest, loveliest kids on earth.
Mm.
So his whatever the challenges facing him, they're not really relevant to the shooting. I mean, God only knows what made this kid do this. I mean, if you look at...
I wonder what's going on there. Yeah.
Well, and if you start... I mean, inevitably the photos of the children killed in this have started to emerge in the last few days, and I mean, it's gut-wrenching to watch.
Sure.
These are 5, 6, 7, 8-year-old kids. How anybody could do what he's done, it beggars belief. But
no, sad situation. It's very sad.
Yeah, look, and I don't understand why the US can't see what the problem is. I mean,
they can see the problem, but there's too strong a lobby, as we saw with that film.
Columbine.
With that. The gun lobby is very strong.
Well, there are about 12,000, I think it's almost 12,500 gun murders in the US last year. You know,
that's,
I think there was
about 1,000 a month
in Britain. Yeah, I mean,
about 1,000 a month.
What,
not bad.
That's right. And what people don't understand is they say, well, it's the constitutional right of Americans to bear arms. People don't understand the history of why that was in there. In the War of Independence, it was the urban militias that helped defeat the British. And so when they crafted the Constitution, they crafted it with that in mind as an acknowledgement of what occurred and the importance of the militias to American independence. But the militias were using, knives and what have you, plus muskets. They weren't using assault rifles.
The old ball and powder,
I don't think that the founding fathers of America intended everybody to be armed to the teeth. But that is what...
With assault rifles, yes.
Yeah, I mean, you just got to wonder why people think they need them. I mean, it's... And look, America...
On the other hand, look at this situation in this country where people can come in and invade your house, and if you do them any damage, you can be charged. If they invade my house, they'd be lucky to walk out alive. I'll take them out.
Look, and that's all about reasonable force. I think the laws are there for good reason, but I think the laws are sometimes not applied very equally.
Yeah.
I mean, people have a right to defend their family, but, you know, the number of times in America where a young kid has taken a weapon from a house that he lives in and used it, to kill someone, either innocently or otherwise, it happens all the time in the US. There was a famous case where a 5-year-old boy took a gun to preschool and shot another, a little 5-year-old girl. I mean, you know, had no idea what he was doing. And tragedies like that are going to happen, but, you know, in the US, it seems to be their culture.
The way societies have developed. Let's move along with it. Let's move along. Let's have a look at something close to home. Our federal government, how are things looking for next year? I mean, the Labor Party seems to be finishing a little bit better in the polls and stuff.
They've been up and down. I mean, they were down, way down at the start of the year.
And then the misogyny speech, that sort of helped quite considerably.
Well, it was the start of the turnaround, wasn't it? And, they've kind of they've held that position ever since. And the poll's out today. There's a Nielsen poll, Fairfax Nielsen poll out today, which shows that Tony Abbott's, what he tried to do in the last week of Parliament over the AWU slush fund affair has backfired on him. I don't think that when they overplayed their hand, unquestionably. I don't think Gillard was entirely honest about the affair, but, you know, if you can't produce the evidence, you know, you've got to move on. And it was not for Julia Gillard to prove her innocence. It was for the opposition to prove that she'd done something wrong, and they didn't. So it's backfired, and the poll out today shows Tony Abbott has reached a new low in his disapproval ratings. In fact, he's approval rating for an opposition leader in 40 years, since Andrew Peacock.
Oh, not before time either, for Abbott. No. Not before time.
And look, the polls are confusing, because I remember facts.
I do.
Which is a terrifying thought.
Well, up here we've got the Queensland Premier's on the nose. Up here there's a recent poll that's in today's papers that more than half of Queenslanders are less likely to vote for the coalition at the next federal election because of the state LNP government. And this is a ReachTel poll conducted for Channel 7 News.
Look, they're one of the real interesting news stories of the year, I think, because it's kind of proof that you can be too successful electorally, and if you are too successful, then bad things are going to follow. A lot of people thought this would happen in New South Wales because the Liberals in New South Wales, of course, had a massive victory. They wiped out Labor in New South Wales, and people thought there's a lot of fairly unstable backbenchers sitting there with nothing to do on the Liberal side. They're going to cause a bit of trouble. O'Farrell's done very, very well to keep his backbench in check. Campbell Newman has done no such thing. He's been a disaster. I don't know how it's been received in Queensland, but I can tell you outside Queensland, people are watching what's happening up there, just shaking their heads. I mean,
well, I'm sure the people that voted him in are up here trying to recall their votes now.
I think they are. Huh? And people are saying, as we do, I mean, it's probably football related, but it could only happen in Queensland. You seem to have a special brand of conservative up there that is genuinely a sandwich short of a hamper.
Like redneck?
Well, yeah. I was trying to be gentle, but yeah, a special brand of redneck. And when they win such a majority, I mean, power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts, absolutely. And I think your Queensland government is walking living proof of that, that people just, their synapses start to misfire when they get such a lead. And I don't like Campbell Newman. I think he's politically quite creepy, but I thought he would have been an effective leader. He's certainly slick. He's not as slick as, say, Peter Beattie, but, you know, he had an air of leadership about him, but he's obviously struggling at the moment, I mean, to keep his party in check. And if you believe all the rumours up there that he was installed by, you know, Feeney and others, well, I suspect there's some truth to that, but in any case, I think you're going to see more of the same in 2013, Tiger. I don't think it's going to stabilise all that much. I don't think it can get much worse, but I think he's going to have a rocky 2013. I think you'll probably survive, but...
All right.
I don't think Abbott will, if you...
Machete Mel. No, well, certainly Abbott shouldn't. Who's likely to take his place, you think?
I think Turnbull's the most likely. The one rule of politics that people should remember and often don't is that politicians, above all else, will always back self-interest. And I'm not being a smart-ass when I say that. That is genuinely how politics works. And senior Liberals are already looking at this and saying, well, at the moment, if an election were held on a two-party preferred basis, the Libs would get through. But as soon as that becomes no longer the case, I think you'll see Abbott get punted. And I think they will put in Turnbull. And if they do, I think they'll win. If they don't, Gillard will win. But I don't think the Libs We'll let it get to that point. The real big gamble they've got is 2013 is an election year, and Gillard can call an election with 6 weeks' notice at any time from February on. Well, at any time. Now, if Abbott really starts to go south and Gillard calls a quick election, the Liberals don't have time to establish a new leader. The best hope they could have is putting in Turnbull, who's reasonably well known as a former opposition leader. But they're in a real difficult position, and if they're going to jump, they have to jump pretty quickly.
All right.
Either over the Christmas break or early in the new year. Otherwise, I think they're stuck with Abbott. And if they're stuck with Abbott, they're going to lose the election, and they know that.
What about the Gillard-Rudd rivalry?
I think that's dead.
You think that's dead?
Yeah. I do. I think, you know, Rudd gave it a good shot. And look, I'm not against Julia Gillard being removed as Prime Minister. I think she's been an appalling Prime Minister. But I don't think Rudd was really much any better. Probably a little bit better, but I think that battle is done.
Right.
Gillard's starting to, if you recall Howard, you know, the days when Howard was incredibly unpopular, and you look at 2001 and the Aston by-election, everybody predicted that Howard would be annihilated. And the way he won it back was A, the Tampa election, one of the most racist in living memory, and B, he just stuck it out, and people ended up respecting him. Well, some people ended up respecting him as someone who could stick it out. And I think Gillard is starting to take on that image as someone who will just tough it out. And that's reasonably popular with the electorate.
Yeah.
I have other views, but I think Gillard will lead them to the next election. I don't think there's any doubt about that.
The Slipper affair. We've seen just last week a court decision involving Ashby, Slipper, Brop's name's in there.
Brough's name's all through it. I sat down one night and read the thing. It's bloody long. It's a very long judgment, but it's everyone should read it if they've got any interest in A, politics, and B, how grubby it can get, because it doesn't get much more grubbier than the Slipper affair. Slipper is claiming he's been vindicated. Of course, he hasn't. His conduct throughout all of, as revealed by a lot of this, was, I think, predatory and very unbecoming, but without question, Ashby is a political animal and a grub, and the guy behind it is Brough, who came out of this a lot of trouble doing it because Peter Slipper was right.
Did a good enough job on his own.
Well, he did. He certainly did. But Brough, really, I mean, what do you say about the man? I think he will probably still.
What's Brough's interest? This is Brough trying to get into that electorate.
Well, Brough, of course, got punted from the seat of Longman, which borders the seat of Fisher, and now the seat of Longman is held by Wyatt Roy, who's the youngest guy ever elected to federal parliament. I think he was 20 or 21 when he was elected. Wyatt's got that seat now sewn up. Brough's never going to win back pre-selection for Longman, so he took on pre-selection for Fisher, and he won it. He won it earlier this year in a very bitter pre-selection battle. So Brough is the official endorsed candidate for the seat of Slipper, for the seat of Fisher. Peter Slipper is the disendorsed Liberal candidate for Fisher, and that's why Brough went after him. He just thought if Slipper decides to run as an independent, Brough needs to do something about Slipper's reputation, so that's why he did it. Although I've got to say, when he got involved in this, he hadn't won the pre-selection for the seat of Fisher. So he had all sorts of motivations to do it. But fundamentally, what Brough is trying to do is win his way back to Parliament. I think he's probably done that, but he's destroyed any hope of ever being installed in a ministry or a cabinet position. There's just no way Brough could ever return to the ministry. He is now perceived and exposed as patently dishonest, which, Tiger, you and I knew all along.
We've known all along.
We did. I mean, this guy, you know, you and I have talked about this a million times, that he couldn't lie straight in bed.
He's got that lie fan up in heaven that old mate uses as a ceiling fan, you know, we tell the lies.
That's right.
Yeah,
you know Mal Brough's lying to you when his lips are moving. That's fundamentally how I view him.
So is the Slipper affair and Ashby and this stuff, is that sort of put to rest now, or is it they're still it's ongoing sort of stuff? He's got to try and clear his name.
No, it's done. It was thrown out of court. They're talking about appealing. I don't know that they will, because A, it costs money, B, it doesn't even necessarily mean their appeal will be heard. But although it will be heard, I suppose. But look, it's essentially over. The only issue that remains is whether or not Mal Brough will retain the Liberals' endorsement for the seat of Fisher. But I think he will. I think the Libs will. The timing's pretty good for them. Christmas is coming. People will probably forget this by January or February when things start to heat up again. So I think you'll see Brough run for the seat of Fisher, and I think he'll probably scrape in it. He hasn't got a huge margin there, but he's got a reasonable margin.
But still, there's no real winners in this, is there? They're all losers. Ashby, Slipper, Brough, really.
Well, they are. And if you look at the impact on our Parliament... and remember that part of Brough's motivation in this was to shift the balance of power in the Parliament, because if he knocked off Slipper as Speaker, it reduced Julia Gillard's margin in the House from 2-1. But Parliament really suffered by this. It was you throw in the Craig Thompson affair, the Liberals running the AWU slush fund, Tony Abbott's bashing of a wall behind the head of a woman. I mean... I've been watching politics for a long time. This has got to be, and I think most people would agree, the most toxic, poisonous year for politics in Australia that I can certainly remember. Mm. And that's saying something, because John Howard used to be in federal parliament. So, really, Tony Abbott, I think, is the cause of a lot of it. And I think that...
All right. Interesting. I'll be on the way out. Well, we've got... The CEO of New South Wales Aboriginal Land Council has now joined us on the line.
My beloved boss.
Your boss. Let's say good day to Jeff Scott. Mr. Scott, welcome to the program. How are you?
Good morning, Tiger. How are you?
Very well.
Thank you for having me.
It's good that you're able to make some time to...
I apologise for that. We had a board meeting. Yes.
No worries.
And it ran a little bit over time.
The New South Wales Aboriginal Land Council meeting is your board? Is it the councillors?
Yeah, it is, yeah.
No worries.
Yeah, at this time of year, there's a lot of business to get through.
I'm sure there is, yes. Well, we're just talking to Chris Graham there about a range of things. Chris, is there anything you want to add in winding up?
Because we might. No, I hope everyone has a good year, and I will leave you with Mr. Scott.
Thanks a lot for holding the fort there.
Pleasure as always.
Keeping us entertained.
Yeah, pleasure, mate. As always, have a good year. We'll have a good end of the year and have a good 2013.
You have a great break, and we'll have to talk again next year.
Done. All right, mate.
Righto. Thank you very much. Bye now. Jeff Scott, tell us your mob, your country.
I'm a Rajri from Central West New South Wales. That's my country.
All right. The situation with New South Wales Aboriginal Land Council, there's been some media recently about the mining exploration and stuff. Tell us a little about it.
About a few. A couple of years ago, the board actually, we've been searching quite a while to see where we can get more advantage out of the economic development opportunities. And one area that we identified some time ago was the potential in the resources sector. So the board has did its appropriate research and then came back in looking at where it could actually get a foothold in that sector. And we've made a number of applications for authorities to get our foot in the door. We've made applications for CSG applications on about 40% of New South Wales, but this is an authority. Well, first of all, you've got a right seeking permission to apply. We did that some 8-9 months ago.
And this is exploration, right? Just to look around and see what's around, what's under the ground.
No, this is just to see. You can't touch the ground.
All right, yeah.
This is just to do desktop survey issues.
Okay.
So we don't even have an authority to do that yet, and which is what I've been trying to explain to a few people. We don't have anything to discuss. All we have is we've made the application. Now, if that were to happen, if we were to get these initial authorities, which are PSPAs, they call them. Petroleum Special Prospecting Authorities, are just to have a look at from a desktop issue. You can't touch the ground. That's a different process, but that's where we're at the moment. And we've also made a number of coal applications, a lease of exploration leases for coal and for uranium, which I know is going to cause a lot of discussion and dispute, but I think it's a debate we have to have before we make a decision whether we're in or out of the tent. And there'll be many, many views on these issues from environmental, cultural, and just a purely principled point of view. And what we're trying to do at the moment is engage in that debate about whether this is possible. Can we do this or can't we?
Right. How long does it take, do you think? When do you expect to hear whether you can or you can't go doing your desktop survey?
On the CSG issues, we had to go through an advertising process, say we intend to apply, and then we go to advertise that in all the papers in the areas where they're circulating. Then you apply, then there's 28 days for objections. We hear we got 700 objections. We'll get those in about February. We've got to respond to every one of those, and then the government will sit down and make a decision whether they'll grant it to us. So probably March, April.
Do you think a considerable number of those objections are from First Nations people across the state?
I think there'll be a few, yes. Mm. And that's good in the process, but we'll be going up to talk to them directly. Mm. I mean, we have the process for petroleum and CSG is required to go through a very structured consultation process with the whole of the community, but we'll be doing additional ones with the Aboriginal community as well. But unless we're testing the water on these, now it's a very, very passionate subject, especially in some areas. But what we're engaging in now is just having that discussion. And from an Aboriginal point of view, I think just to ensure that they're making decisions with all the information before them.
Just look at if the approval is given, if you're able to do your desktop, your surveys, and you find, yes, it could be worthwhile mining here, mining there. What happens then? What's the next step? Where do you go?
We've sent complete information package to every one of our land councils and other interested people around the state about what the process is from start to finish. But if you should get a PSPA, Petroleum Special Prospecting Authority, you're able to do a desktop analysis. You know, look at the seismic studies, the radiology, all the rest of it. If you then think, then you usually narrow your field back to where these studies show there's most potential, because you've got to de-risk these processes as you go through. Then you have to apply for a PEL, which is a Petroleum Exploration Licence. And that's another process of consultation, advertising, community issues, again, before you get to that point. That gives you the right to touch the ground, put a drill down. If you were, after having that process, then think there is something there that you actually wish to actually mine or extract, you apply for a PAL, Petroleum Assessment Licence, which enables you to go through all the different parts of the rules and the controls, the environmental factors and reports. Before you get to a PPL, which is Petroleum Production Licence, that's when you take product. So it's quite a long process, but the issue for New South Wales, I think, Tiger, is that New South Wales imports 95% of its gas needs. And with many of the current fields moving to the export market, there's likely to be a shortage in a very short period of time.
All right.
So that's why I identified this as a potential area. Mm. And there's been different responses around the state. I went to a forum out in the west.
Sorry, that's Jeff. So, with your view, or what your advice is, what you're saying is, you need to get out and just explain to people, particularly the land council constituents, just exactly what the process is.
And what the controls are, what the disadvantages, advantages, potential. Mm. And go through it all, and then we're asking, and that's why we're engaging, trying to get out there and just talk to people about it, and we're getting information together at the moment. We've sent packs about the process to every land council and anyone else who's interested, that what the process is, what we're after, why we're doing this. We've been doing that for the past 8 months, and if we were to get the PSPA, we have to ramp that up and actually go out and hold public meetings.
All right.
And that's required.
So she's a long, drawn-out process.
Oh, yeah. Oh, it is.
Hmm. But at the end of it, like the ultimate objective is economic independence or an economic base.
Yeah, well, the council took a view that for too long the mining sector is proceeding, and the point on this is if we don't do it, someone else will. You know, most profit destination is not within the shores of Australia. I mean, and on this one, we looked at the issue, and we, in the resources sector, we say we're not going to engage with it unless we have equity, which we're a part owner. or even the majority owner, and looking for equity in these and long-term income streams so we can actually meet the needs of our people, not rely on government benevolence anymore.
Yeah.
Because the experience has shown that comes with a conditionality that to many people is unacceptable.
Yes, it certainly is, and it's like being stuck between a rock and a hard place.
It is, and the council are very aware of that. This is not an easy thing to do, and it may be the case that we can't do things. We may be able to, but we're trying to test the water, if you like.
Yeah, right.
And there are some communities which are saying, yes, do it now, it's happening anyway. It's better if we're involved in it, not waiting for the crumbs off the table. And there are others saying, no, I don't care who you are, I will oppose you.
Right.
Now, people are entitled to that view, entirely. And we could listen to those views when we get out, should we get something we actually talk about. And the process on applying for these, when the applications opened up, it was a matter of hours to apply, not even days. When they're open, if you don't get in the door within hours, you're not in the door at all.
So you're saying it's something that wasn't, there wasn't any real planning in this, there wasn't any real discussion, it was just an opportunity jumped in.
There's a lot of planning and discussion around how we could get into these issues. We then started searching for opportunities. Now, the gas ones came up because the government opened up the opportunity. Then we had to see whether it was possible or not. And the way it became possible is that on the government websites, they opened up applications and the first in, first served. And so to some extent, as soon as we come back to the point of saying there's an opportunity here, we should make applications in this area, we sent notes to all the land councils saying we had made these approaches. This is where we're at. That's all the information we have.
Yeah.
Until we actually get something, then we've got to go out and say, well, this is what it actually means, or this is potentially what could and couldn't happen, and we have discussions around it.
You've had some criticism, some flack from constituents, First Nations people in the state. What about government? Any thoughts or ideas of how government thinks about this?
No.
Nothing.
They're silent.
Yeah, yeah.
Would have thought they would have looked at this as an opportunity of actually getting people to a point where we have an income stream which enables a degree of independence to be a good thing, but we've heard nothing from any level of government other than to put in press releases that we're involved.
And you're a bit surprised by that?
Well, to be honest, no.
Yeah.
In my experience, government likes to control. This is not about control. This is about just moving to a point where we don't have that control. I mean, the way the government engages with the Aboriginal community, well, not just the Aboriginal community, I think the whole of the third sector of that report, is projects which are conditional. You know, what do you do, how long you go for, who's involved, what your outcome should be, how long it will go for. You have no say. And if you don't agree, you just don't get any resources to do it.
Yes, that's certainly evidence is abundant that that's how governments work.
It's evidence that the government's not interested in the declaration at all.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we know this is controversial, but I think we should. Aboriginal people shouldn't want that conditional support from the Greens or all the other side.
Yeah, this sort of conflicting views, or not so much conflicting views, but other people's views on what Aboriginal people, First Nation people should be doing is...
Yes. Well, we have the Green movement up there engaging these people who are now writing Dreamtime stories for us under the banner of the coal seam gas close the gate about how the great snake will rise up and bite us. Now, a bit trite, I would have thought. Anyway, that's what they've done.
Right. I've got a caller on the line.
Okay.
Doug. Yes, Doug, how are you?
Yeah, good, thanks, Doug. How you going?
Very well, very well. What would you like to say?
Mate, I've been following the coal seam gas debate for quite a while with a bit of interest, both from First Nations person, as I am, as you know, and from the Indigenous side of things. So what I see and understand, and I might be a bit ignorant, that the Indigenous people are getting sweet fanny Adam out of what's going on with the coal seam. White fellas seem to benefit quite a bit, and I can say that because I am a white fella. But what I find concerning as well is also the environmental impact on this. Like, I've got a friend out of Chinchilla there. He's had beef cattle all his life. He's a second, third generation farmer. And it's that bad. His well, that used to be stock water, you can actually light it up as the water comes out.
I've seen the media reports how they can light up water rolls and stuff.
It's coal. He's a good friend of mine, that fella.
Yeah.
And plus, I used to deliver to a lot of these sites when I was driving for a big company. And the degradation you see in the salt that comes out of the water sitting in those ponds is like crystallised. You know, it can't be good for anything.
They're right, yeah.
That's just my views.
It's good to hear.
I think Doug's quite entitled to those views and those concerns. But, one is I've seen many water bores where you actually light them up and they're on fire as well. But the issue is you've got to be very careful about these issues and try and limit any potential damage to it. And the technology is getting better all the time. I mean, the chemicals are not ever used anymore, which is good. The fracking methods are getting much better. And we've got to look at all those and take them into account before we go anywhere near these issues.
If we're talking about degradation. We're talking about degradation of country and stuff too. Well, the beef industry isn't one of the better ones either, is it?
Well, I would think the reason we have such a problem in this country is we have farming methods that are not suited to the country.
Yes.
But that's another debate.
It is. So it's a bit hard to sort of say one's safer than the other or better for the country than the other.
Yeah, but in all these debates, we agree water is essential.
Mm.
We've got to protect those issues.
Yes.
In terms of the salt and degradation, there are different methods of now of actually the ponding and trying to get the salt content out before it's actually re-released into the system itself. And we're going through all those processes now. And where the degradation has happened is where some of the ponds haven't they've leaked. You know, that happens, then you've got a real issue. But it happens with most things.
Yeah, there's a risk, a degree of
There's always risk. A risk here. It's about how much risk that people are prepared to accept or is acceptable.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's going to take some time, and we'll certainly stay in touch and get some updates as developments take place. There was what else has happened over the year, reflecting over the year for the New South Wales Land Council network? Some wins along the way?
I think there have been. I mean, we've started up a few issues at the moment. We've had a number of land claim wins, which are very significant. And it's been, we do it, do try and keep under the radar on these ones to make sure we actually get the benefits for the local land councils themselves. We're coming up to our 30th year anniversary this year, or next year, in 2013. So that's a good time to reflect on issues and see how we come and where we go to next. We can't sort of sit back and just hope things happen. We have to plan and be the initiator. Facilitate things.
What are the plans for the anniversary, Jeff?
The statewide conference for all the land councils will be on in about June or July. We didn't have one every 2 years to bring people together. You know, it's not cheap, but I think it's essential that people get the opportunity to get together. And the other one is that's the 30-year anniversary, and the board's now considering how they're going to actually celebrate that. There was no going out to the local land councils seeking their views on that. But at the moment, we'd like to have a bigger celebration as possible, but it's all conditional upon how much money we have or resources we can draw. But again, it's a time of a lot of change at the moment, so there's opportunity around. We've got to keep searching for them. And we keep searching for economic opportunities where we can. And I think one of our great challenges is how do you do that, including the commercial realities of having to maintain a degree of not secrecy but confidentiality, in doing commercial arrangements and keeping the mob informed. That's an ongoing challenge for us.
How is New South Wales faring under the present economic climate insofar as maintaining that investment fund and generating enough interest to keep the network going?
It went all right. Now, last year, we've only got about a 4% return, which is still 2% in front of the government. But that shook us down a little bit. But if this current year... it's doing very well. I think we're about 80% toward our benchmark for the whole year. We're only in December now, so we'd hope we exceed that in the current year. Our overseas investments are doing very well. The local ones not so well. The local investments are doing well, the overseas not so well. And the high dollar is not helping us. But on the whole, it's doing quite well, actually. Better than we expected, but at the same time, we've got to have restraint on expenditure to make sure we have that fund there for the future.
What about the situation with land claims and being able to turn things around where you're not land or asset rich and cash poor? The government cooperating?
Well, there's very little cooperation in these matters. I think we have a new government in power here at the moment. They've been in for a little while now, but they're still deciding how they're going to go about things. The minister's looking at an economic development statement, and it'll be good to see that in the future. But they're taking their time in coming to their position. I said, with the majority they have, you can afford to do that. It's a bit like Queensland. But the opportunities are there, and we just keep trying to... We've got to make sure our doors are open for business. We have a responsibility to our own mob out there to do the best we can and move people to a point where we're not relying on... They have a better future than we had.
What are some of your... couple of your main goals for 2013?
Oh, the board is redoing its corporate plan at the moment, but a real focus on actually getting on top of what land local land councils have and that we have ourselves, and making sure we make decisions around what's the appropriate use of that land. And this is outside the whole resource sector development, because we're operating there as a mining company, if you like. But the land that they have, a lot of land that local land councils have is prime for development if they so choose to. But that's a decision for the members of the council. They may decide not to develop that land, to keep it in its current condition. They may decide to exercise some, but that process will happen this year. And it's sort of getting to a point where we have proper, you can call it asset management planning if you like, but it's just looking out the country. So that process is moving on. We have a review of legislation on this year. There's a review of the culture and heritage legislation here, which is akin to managed destruction at the moment. Many, many sites have been destroyed. But the whole of the government here and the whole of the legal regime is undergoing enormous change. I mean, the planning laws have been redone, the Crown Lands Act's been redone, and most of the social programs are being wound back, as they are with the Commonwealth. So most of DEW is withdrawing their resources from everywhere. But they're challenges for us that we'll take on in the new year. I would hope that the environment improves a little in the next 6 months.
Mm. When
we have very little contact with the Commonwealth Government at all. I don't think we live in the right part of the country for that.
What would be required from the Commonwealth Government? Where do you think the Commonwealth Government should interact or should engage? In what areas?
Well, on these issues, we have massive infrastructure problems at the moment. I mean, on infrastructure, we pay for all of it. We have no support from government at all. And it costs New Zealand $100 million to actually look after the reserves in the state. No one else, no other... No other people, be Aboriginal or non-Aboriginal, do that anywhere, but we've had to. So more engaged in the Commonwealth, recognising and coming to a sustainable, taking a sustainable approach to providing assistance and support. Not this project mantra of dependence would be a good way of going about that, but that'll take a bit of an epiphany from government to have a change to that. We can only hope we work on that. We've got the declaration coming up now, whether it's going to be implemented or not. That's a real issue for us. At the moment, we're all talking about an act of recognition. Well, an act of respect might be a good one to have before we get to that point. So we're not much engaged in those sort of issues, but we're trying to be on the ground, trying to improve the living conditions of people in our communities.
When you say the New South Wales spends $100 million on infrastructure, you're talking about just the reserves, what was once lands trust.
There are 66 ex-reserves in the state, now owned by the local land councils. In terms of the infrastructure on the reserves, there's been an ad hoc program of a number of years to support those, but we're trying to get to a point where they're managed properly and sustainably and not relying on injections of money from the government all the time. We'd like to get to a point where we can do that ourselves. Now, if we'd access the Grants Commission, as anyone else in the community has, maybe that could be done, but that's been denied Aboriginal people. So we have to do it ourselves.
Because of the Land Rights Act has been denied?
No, because... We're deemed as private landholders, and therefore we can't access the Commonwealth Grants Commission for infrastructure projects. The Infrastructure Australia looks at these things, but for some reason New South Wales is persona non grata for the Commonwealth in that respect. We're trying to actually subdivide all the reserves at the moment, because a lot of MBOB wants some certainty about where they live even on the reserves themselves, so they have some certainty about their family having a bit of structure and long-term tenure of the house they live in or the area they've always lived in. Now, we can't get to that point. One, because the planning laws are being redone here, and the second, because we need some assistance in doing the infrastructure cost. It just means we've still got to divert more and more money away from other programs we should run to meet the cost of where government has withdrawn its support and failed to meet its duties to Aboriginal people as just citizens of this country.
That's outrageous. That's outrageous when the government can withdraw its step back, shirk its responsibilities for basic infrastructure. That's just outrageous.
Well, I think the government will only... It's a conditionality we're facing at the moment.
Mm.
You don't get support unless you're subservient. That's not a way forward, nor is it sustainable.
Well, it certainly paints a picture that may help people understand the need for exploration licences and to look at the resources sector to see how you can turn things around.
That's why the board's gone this way in terms of frustration, but in terms, if you're going to have some, you can talk about self-determination, independence issues, but that also includes the right to make decisions as you see, as you do, not just based on someone else's view. Now, the board's going to take those very carefully, but the pitch for the resources sector is a consequence of that, if you like, abrogation of responsibility from the government and the need for us to be sustainable without relying on anyone else. The day we don't rely on the benevolence of government will be a great day, I think. We can talk about self-determination truly on that day.
Certainly we'll be able to. Mate, we're about at the end of time. It's certainly good to catch up for a quick one towards the end of the year.
No, thank you very much for the opportunity, all the listeners, and wish them all a Merry Christmas. And sorry about being late, but the board says do something, and
exactly.
I must do it.
Yeah, you've got to be there for that. No worries. You have a great Christmas, and we look forward to talking to you again in the new year, talking about the developments of the New South Wales Aboriginal Land Rights Act.
Okay, thank you very much, Sagan.
Thanks, Jeff.
Wish you a good Christmas. Bye.
Yeah, mate, you have a good one. Bye now. Jeff Scott, the CEO of New South Wales Aboriginal Land Council. Now, as you heard him say, they pay $100 million a year to keep those communities, those reserves and communities, First Nations communities going, electricity and housing and water, basic infrastructure. They are government responsibilities. But because they are a landowner under the New South Wales Aboriginal Land Rights Act of 1983, they don't get access to the grants and things like that to keep going, as Shire Councils and other groups do. Catch-22 situation. And it's no wonder that they are looking at the resources sector. No wonder when the government can shirk its responsibility for First Nations people in New South Wales that are living on communities and reserves. It's just downright criminal. And no federal government engagement or discussion with those people in those communities. Such as Tumula. We hear about Tumula all the time. The poor conditions down there. New South Wales Aboriginal Land Council has to. Are the ones that come to the party to sort those things out. Well, it's time for me to go. Join me tomorrow.